are you do for the rest of your life? We could watch the stars at night twinkling high above. 'Cause I promise you for the rest of your life, well, I will be there by your side. I will be.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Wednesday edition of The French Connection. Today's date is Wednesday, February 7th, 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me this evening. I'll give you my details. IamTheWitness.com is the website, and Smith@IamTheWitness.com is the contact of the email address. Lots of things happening in the world, of course, and we did a great 45-minute rant last night trying to identify people who are trying to undermine the facts. The facts are that we can go back in history. The historical referencing that it can be done that proves without a doubt some of the contentions we have made over time are irrefutable. And one of the things that we've brought on many times to this programming is the British perspective. And I have a dear friend and somebody I've worked with closely over the months working with me this evening. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Barry Turner, retired British military. He is he's a wonderful human being. He's a researcher and just a guy that he wants the facts. He wants to know the truth about what goes on in his nation and the world. And he's done his due diligence by some of the old-fashioned way of looking through research, which is, I think, to be applauded, because oftentimes we rely on what the internet has to tell us, and you know, it is a cesspool of disinformation, not unlike what you'd find in printed form either, but somewhat different, I think. Anyway, I'm going to bring Barry up right now. Barry, are you with me?
Yes, I am indeed, yes.
It's nice to have you with me here again, Barry. You know, one of the things that I've noticed recently is that the pressure is building on the Blair government, and there's an awakening happening across Britain, and many people, it seems like, aren't sure what has happened, but they're certain that something's going on. You want to talk a little bit about what your feelings are, about what is the sense in the country right now?
Well, I think one of the problem basically at this point in time is that we're watching a government which appears to be coming apart at the seams.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid it has a history of a prime minister who plays or would like to play a presidential role, which is totally different to yours, since we have a different constitution altogether. Would like to play a presidential, attempts to play a presidential role and ride roughshod over the normal parliamentary procedures. Unfortunately, he's been kept in power for getting on for 10 years
yep.
through the parliamentary whip. And a huge majority, which has kept him in power. And members of parliament have little independence, I'm afraid. One or two have broken loose, such as Michael Meacher, who was an environment minister. In other words,
and Claire Short, wasn't Claire, she ran for the hills. Claire Short did, didn't she?
Well, she went along with it for a time. She was overseas development secretary. Unfortunately, she unleashed GM policies into the third world, including India. I don't think she quite honestly knew the implications, but it was during a period when, of course, Labour were running with people like Monsanto.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, it's done an enormous amount of damage, but she eventually pulled out. One of the great problems, of course, has been Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, Iraq, we know now, and there's no doubt about it, was the invasion was mounted on a lie.
Yep.
It was planned in July or thereabouts of the year before the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew what was called the dodgy dossier was, in fact, a fraud.
Yep.
It went through the United Nations Security Council. Now, all the way along the line, Blair's justified this and changed his ground for the reasons for invading Iraq at each stage. Now, this is palpable nonsense. And everybody knows it. The problem, I think, with Blair, in my view, is purely my interpretation. I believe, and he's never run a business to my knowledge in his life, not even held a ministerial post before becoming prime minister. He went straight to the top.
Well, he was anointed by the powers behind him, and we've got the Lord Goldsmith and we've got Lord Levy, don't we? Two people behind the power, behind the throne?
These are people who are powerful in those circles. I wouldn't say they were the moving forces.
Who is the moving force in the City of London?
Well, I believe that Blair, who loves to parade the globe announcing his initiatives, which tend to be meaningless, lives a life rather like Walter Mitty. You remember the Secret Life of Walter Mitty?
I do.
A Danny Kaye film.
Yeah,
where a weak man plays heroic roles. I clearly remember Danny Kaye assuming the role of a Battle of Britain fighter pilot. Now, I believe this is about the level of Blair's ability. But he's been manipulated, of course, and aided by a huge machine which he in part has created around him. And this, of course, led to the invasion of the Balkans.
Interesting that we located information that says that this false group Al-Qaeda, which has been foisted upon us all as a real organization, and of course, if you know anything about the language, the Arabic language, it means the base, but many countries in Arabia use it as a term to using the toilet. Oddly enough, but this group was actually employed by Blair and by Clinton, then Bush, in the Balkans and other places as a ally, not as an enemy. In fact, in the Balkan War, when he was Bill Clinton's best friend, Al-Qaeda was walking side by side with that KLA group. And of course, they switched sides as soon as we needed the new bad guy with bin Laden and the rest. But Al-Qaeda has just morphed from one group to another.
Well, I think it's on record now. There's a book. I can't remember the title of the book. It's the links between President the Bush family and the Saudi royals. And, of course, the bin Laden family are part of that connection. Without any doubt, the terrorists, the war against terror has been manipulated on a sort of wave of concern about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. But the whole thing strikes me as being a very thin fabric indeed. But, you know, you go back to the Kissinger Plan of 1975.
Right.
When there was a plan, uncovered by James E. Aiken, so I think it'd be the United States ambassador in Saudi Arabia, a plan to, in effect, colonize the Gulf states, not Iraq, but colonize the Gulf states, I put that term in inverted commas, to introduce American oil people to dominate the Gulf for the sake of the resources. Now, you know, you go back that far, you can go back even further, you can go back 50 years before that, when the manipulation began, after the end of the First World War. But, I mean, it has gone on, and we simply change the goalposts when it suits us.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. Do you remember a movie called 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford?
No, I don't.
Well, it was a 1971 movie, and the premise of the movie was that someone had discovered that the CIA and other groups had fomented a plan that was revolved around in taking over the Middle East.
Mm.
In other words, they put these stories out in film form and in storyboard form long before they execute them. If you take a look back in time as well, before 9/11, they were putting out television shows where planes hit the World Trade Center.
Well, it's either preparing the ground blowing the plot. It depends which way you look at it and who's involved.
Right.
It works either way. But if you look at Serbia, I mean Serbia, Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia was a communist state outside the global economy.
Yep.
And it was also a missing part of the European mosaic. Now, of course, it's all falling into place. What we're not told in this particular case is anything about this huge American base in Albania, a military base in Albania. Now, this is hardly a question of liberation. Another one, which is out, I've only read, it may have appeared in other publications, but I've only read in a very minor publication called The Social Creditor, all about money, about this huge American embassy, which is being established in Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, this is hardly freedom and democracy for the Iraqi people. It is an American control center. According to the report, the size of the Vatican City, with a brigade of Marines to garrison it. Now, you talk about embassies. The whole concept is laughable. And for all the exposures of the iniquities of what has gone on in Iraq and continue to go on, I don't think any newspaper has made a song and dance about this particular establishment. Now, why do they fall short of exposing something like that?
Well, you know why, and we can get into that, because I think this is really important. And interesting, when you take a look behind the American governmental process, the Congress, Senate and congressmen are thoroughly tied up with this APEC group. In every high-ranking position within governmental decision-making in the United States, these people are predominant in their control. And if not actually from the Jewish minority in the country running it, they're henchmen, because you look at the policy choices, and it's always on behalf of a decision for Israel or for these very wealthy people sitting in New York. And interestingly, it parallels what happened in the First World War with Morgenthau and Baruch and Brandeis and all the rest of them. This is an ongoing story, Barry, and I wonder, you know, is it America? I don't think the public, first of all, has any idea just how bad the rot is. But you can go back to the city of London as well, or even over to Frankfurt and over into Tel Aviv. The thread goes through these cities, and it's pretty clear after you've looked at it, and you've done this for years, you've looked at it. What do we do to put this story out there in a public way where people can really wrap themselves around these facts? Because it's a very hard story to sell to the mainstream, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, this is a vexed history, and it's perfectly well known. I think one has to be absolutely honest and impartial about any analysis and any statements made. One approach, of course, which is perfectly logical, is to simply record all the dots and see where the line goes through them.
And let people make their own mind up after they take a look at it.
Now, I think it was the Jewish Chronicle about a week ago reported a conference in London about action to be taken against Iran.
Mm.
Now, chairing that conference was one Michael Gove, a recently elected Conservative Party member of Parliament. Now, he is a dedicated Zionist. He is Jewish. And you see, there is a man already in an influential position, embedded in the Conservative Party.
Yep.
Now, that automatically inhibits any approach on this particular axis, as it were, because there's no doubt at all. I mean, America and Israel have conferred on the action to be taken. Now, Israel is a little state of about 5 million. It should be sort of growing oranges and exporting fruit and a tourist center, instead of which it's an arms manufacturer. It's a nuclear power, which the present prime minister, of course, has blown and was severely criticized in his own Jewish press for doing so. But everybody's known it. But you see, it's been veiled for so long. Now, these tentacles, of course, do extend far. The names can be followed into many areas. But, of course, one has to be absolutely objective and not critical of ordinary people or Jewish people who just want to get on with their lives. And
well, that's exactly right. And what we do, when I make a connection between a crime or criminal activity or some kind of conspiracy that is, reasonably sure is provable, we have to declare that that is for a Zionist cause, not a Jewish cause. Because once you start, defaming an entire religion where there are people that have nothing to do with it, you run the risk of a pogrom that would end up, sweeping up innocents. And of course, that would certainly not be my goal or anybody who's got any morality, their goal. But at the same time, when you go back to this, I mean, you know, I think the group in Britain that has just come out against what's happening in Israel and the Zionist cause, and they're saying, we don't want this stuff happening in our name, and it's hitting the front pages.
The Jews for Justice. That's absolutely right, of course. The Jewish Chronicle has been fairly open-handed about this, fairly even-handed. Unfortunately, there are people who write in that newspaper who are fervently Zionist and almost obsessively so, irrationally so. I think I said before on your program, I long for the time when the late Shane Berman used to write the leaders, and he was a very balanced, very wise man, and I kept a lot of his articles. The Jews for Justice, you see, act as academics. I think it was Professor Klug was writing in the British Guardian newspaper, and they were stating quite bluntly that the Zionist element does not speak for all the Jews. Adamant about this, and of course, there's a very strong wave of sympathy for the Palestinians, and quite rightly so. I mean, the fate of the Palestinians is borne out by the last 50 years of history.
Well, they've genocided them, the society, in large measure.
You see, you get into this anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and the deliberate confusion between the two terms.
That's right.
And it is neither to analyze the history and produce facts. Now, currently, in the last possibly 5 years or so, perhaps a bit more, it has been regarded, the hostility between Israel and the Palestinian lands has been promoted as a tit-for-tat. Now, it's all very well at this point in time. This is the stage it has reached. But in previous years, I have a stack of UNRWA reports. This is the United Nations, not any old body. UNRWA reports of the atrocities committed against the Palestinians. Now, that was very one-sided. No wonder we had two wars in 67 and 73. It was bound to happen the way the land was taken. Now, I also got to know very well the two founders of Medical Aid for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Major Cooper, and I'm sure I mentioned this one before, Major Cooper was second in command of the Life Guard and the last British troops out of Palestine in 1948, and he saw personally what was being done to the Palestinians. Now, his wife and he, from the mid-1950s onwards, worked for various charities, Save the Children, the UNESCO. They worked on the Hungarian uprising, the Persian earthquake, and so on and so forth. But they were in West Beirut during the Sabra Shatila massacre, and they knew this from the inside. They demonstrated with both Palestinian people and Jewish people against this situation. So there's certainly a strong Israeli element.
Yeah. But we've looked at these Jabotinskys, okay? This group of virulent Irgun descendant Ashkenazi criminals that we've discovered are operating quite openly in the United States under many different family names. One of them is Rahm Emanuel, and his father was an Irgun member, and in fact carried out terrorism in 1948. But you can follow back some of the same people, such as Netanyahu and even this guy Chertoff's connections. The fact is that this is an unbroken line of virulent Zionist criminals that will murder at the drop of a hat to get their ends met. They have suspended any moral code in order to meet their ends.
Well, of course, just after the end of the war, two future Israeli prime ministers, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, I think it was, were both listed as war criminals. I got the wanted posters for both of them. No attempt was ever made to bring them to justice.
Nor was an attempt made on Sharon after Shatila and Sabra and Shatila.
He got into a certain amount of hot water, but I think that was inevitable. But he certainly should have been tried. I mean, why only certain people tried at the European Court of Justice, is it? I think I got the title right.
That's right.
It's very one-sided. And it's really the winner's justice, the victor's justice. And this is, well, look at the way Saddam was tried and executed. If he'd been tried on the Halabja episode, it would have drawn in people, as we know only too well, like Donald Rumsfeld and others who were involved in his behind the scenes.
You know, we can carry these threads around and know that there is just a small group of people pushing this agenda forward. But when you take a look at history, and this is where I think you've got some strength, because you've looked at the earliest forms of this sickness that we're looking at today in the world. You know, the Balfour signing and of course getting America into the war for the first time, and then the second war being set up. And you can look at the threat of money. And here's the interesting one that I'd like to talk about, because debt-based money systems in the world are under the single control of this group that we're talking about now at their highest level. And when you start understanding that Serbia was outside that financial system up until they were invaded, and Iran happens to be outside it right now, and Iraq was outside it, what you find is that all the countries that are not sitting within their banking system are being forced to join.
Well, I mean, look at the case of Malaya and during Muhtar Mohamed's time as Prime Minister.
Yep.
It has a long history, of course, and one has to be careful not to jump to undue conclusions. One has to look at the facts and read quite a range of books and look at press histories, because if you're not careful, you do sort of become something of a conspiracy theorist. Now, there's no doubt about the conspiracy, but conspiracy theorist is a trigger term used to deter people from coming to conclusions based on facts.
Yeah.
I believe everybody should start with a clean sheet, work through the evidence, and come to their own conclusions. And if they come to the conclusions that probably you and I do, then, you know, it's validated. But there's a tremendous groundswell, as it were, of suspicion, which websites like yours have generated. But at the same time, there's a deliberate veil drawn over a great deal of what we ought to be looking at, and people have to dig.
If you
go back, and it's just tossing one or two balls in the air, and letting people work it out for themselves. Now, Chancellor Rathenau in 1912, and he was Jewish, I believe.
Yeah.
Stated that 300 men who know each other and constantly select those who will succeed them direct the economic destinies of the world. Now, when a head of state makes a statement like that, he ought to know what he's talking about. And this, of course, goes right back to Benjamin Disraeli's time, when in one of his novels the same sort of thing was said.
Yeah.
Now, at a banquet in London in November 1937, Fabian Nicholas Murray Butler said, "Communism is the instrument with which the financial world can topple national governments and erect a world government with world police and world money." Now, again, when somebody, an academic as well known as that, makes a statement like that. Now, between these two dates in 1931, Professor Arnold Toynbee, tied to the Royal Institute of International Affairs, known as Chatham House colloquially, delivered an address in which he stated that the national identity, nation states, would be liquidated by stealth. Those are not his exact words, but that is the gist of what he was saying. Now, when you put these things together and you look at the evolution of financial power, we are at a stage when the world is facing debt slavery at the hands of an increasingly consolidated banking system. Now, who actually controls it? Is a question one has to
well now I've looked behind that veil, and what I've discovered in my research is of course, the Bank of International Settlement, which we talked about recently, you and I.
Yes.
Of course, that's the bank of the bankers. And that's where central banks and where short-term overnight large transfers of cash are garnered. The fact is it's always debt-based, and it's always subservient to future repayment on a fractional reserve basis. And this system is completely controlled by a few people. And you take a look at the founders of the Fed, and what you'll find is they're using the American money system, the dollarized world, and of course they used the same system when the world was using the pound. I mean, when the British Empire had no sunset upon it, the pound was king, and they were using that as a debt service currency. But what you find now with the dollar, the instruments that they're able to use, like derivatives and shorting and swaps and all this other stuff, they've got the world so tied up with nonsensical financial instruments that people don't know if up is down and right is left.
Well, of course, they're not told. They're not told during their sort of educational phase, and then certainly not allowed to be told by the media. And if you have books, a number of very good books written about this, but you will not find them reviewed in the mainstream media. But I think this is where both the banking system and the media and the big corporations need analyses. Now, one has to look at the interconnections between the ownerships of these organizations, the interconnection between the boards of directors, as we call them in this country.
Yeah.
Now, there was a very good television program three or four years ago, and it revolved around some major exposure in the country and a campaigning editor who backed his reporter, and everything was going quite well, and they'd gone deeply into the plot. I can't remember the details of the plot. Until the editor was called to a very private meeting in a panel boardroom with the chairman of the group owning the newspaper, and he was given the gypsy's warning, that's enough, drop it. Now, this undoubtedly is the way newspaper editors are controlled, they don't want something to appear in the public.
When they have a slight touch of independence, because what we find today in the United States media is those jobs are now held by people we know are working very closely with Zionism, and you can see it with the purchase of most of the large media groups in Disney under Eisner, which is clearly working with these people, and the Brofman fortune buying into it. You can take a look at it with CNN and Levin and the rest of them. In other words, or Rupert Murdoch, well, hand in glove with these people. When you take a look at that whole story, Barry, you start understanding that they have, in fact, replaced most of these editors with people who don't even make the original mistake of trying to find the truth.
Well, in terms of which particular faction or culture is controlling it, I think the first thing to do, of course, is identify the names and the network. Now, not everybody is of the same sort of inclination, as it were. There are independent-minded people around, but one simply has to list the names. The, if you take the Rathenau, if I can go back to Rathenau, 300 men who know each other and constantly select those who will succeed them, you only have to take the Rockefeller and the Rothschild dynasties to see that in something like, 200 years, there is an incredible succession. The names haven't changed. Now, this can happen in industry. A major company may be run by a family, like the Rupert Murdoch runs his newspaper empire with his daughter and a couple of sons, I think it is. But that's only through, father and son succession. What comes out of that? But this one has been going on for 200 years or so.
Well, but you have to understand, too, though.
The names don't change. It's in the family.
But, Barry, interesting. When you go back into the Rockefeller history, they were given their seed money by Rothschild to exploit Standard Oil. And once they built the fortune of Standard Oil, they were also in league with other they call them the robber barons, but all, if you take a look at Pierpont Morgan and the rest of them, their seed money came from Europe, and it came from this Rothschild fortune. So every one of them owed their allegiance back to this main place. And even today, even Henry Ford, who came out very virulently against these people, his system was bought up when Ford went into a trust system. In other words, they transferred much of Henry Ford's wealth into a trust, so the trust is perpetual. In other words, that's why you'll see the Ford name continuing generation after generation, because yes, by legal construct, it's going to remain the Ford Trust. The question then becomes, who's in charge of that trust?
Well, you also have this question of investment. Now, it's something which burrows along below the surface. Now, we have it's hugely complex. We're talking about a global system, in effect, and who controls it. And there's plenty of evidence, for instance, going out to New Zealand and Australia in this global financial system. But one can see the connections. Now, you don't necessarily know who have controlling interests. There's this network, certainly of Rothschild banks, and occasionally in the Pink Pages you read about a Rothschild interest being established in some country, almost unexpectedly, but suddenly they're there. Mm-hmm. Now, the extent to which this octopus of investment and financial control does control the system as a whole, because you've come across many corporations, manufacturing corporations, pharmaceutical and the rest, agrochemical corporations, you don't necessarily know who actually controls the purse strings in the final analysis.
Well, and let's tell the reason why that is, Barry, because people need to understand corporate structure. 70-80% of the shares that are outstanding are generally not traded on the stock market. They're held. And only a small fraction of the company's value is traded on a daily basis. So the rest of it remains in hands of people who control trusts, or they control insurance companies. Now, if you take a look at a company like AXA, which is the world's largest insurer, AXA is a Rothschild company. Take a look at Europe's largest bank, who also has big holdings, the BNP Paribas. That is also a Rothschild bank. If you take a look at the largest corporate bank in Europe and in the world, it's Lazard Frere. In other words, you can go down these lists and start understanding that they don't have to have their name circulated, because they're basically holding the majority shareholdings.
Well, when the biotechnology explosion took place, the early time of the Blair government, AstraZeneca was a major player in this particular league. Obviously, it was a growing market with a huge amount of scientific development potential, and, of course, commercial potential. Now, if you looked at the board membership of AstraZeneca, and you looked at the lead back to Rothschild Finance in the Channel Islands, you get another link. Now, all you can do is say, well, there is a link.
Yep.
If you take Khodorkovsky, the Jewish oligarch, oil oligarch, who's been under arrest some time in Russia, at some stage, and it was announced in the financial press, Lord Nathan Rothschild got involved with some sort of delegated financial power to protect the Khodorkovsky investment. I think it was established in Gibraltar, something like that. But he was on record. And during the Guinness scandal, now we're going back, about 20 years in this country, the Guinness share scandal, all the names, most of the names, I say, were of the same, shall we say, culture.
Yeah.
Now,
Is that a coincidence, you think?
Names joined by dotted lines. And this has happened in many financial reports where the same dotted lines have appeared.
Mm.
Now, I take no issue one way or the other on this, save to say that is what is fact.
Yeah.
One has to draw one's conclusions from it without going overboard. Otherwise, of course, you pull the whole thing down, and any analysis loses credibility.
Well, and we're not sitting in these boardrooms with the red phone up to the top. We don't know.
You won't be told. Who refinances Rupert Murdoch? Now, here's News International. I seem to remember from an annual report, not all that long ago, 3-4 years ago, was hugely in debt. Not that it was broke, but that it needed refinancing. Because you're into another game now, of course. These big corporations need money to keep them going. And the only way they get money to keep them going is by borrowing,
yeah.
Restructuring, and all the rest of the terminology. And you build this huge this huge mountain of debt, which is simply spiraling up and up and up. And, of course, it's gathering power to itself at the same time. I've described this more than once as rather like a child's top spinning upside down, like a cone spinning upside down, getting ever larger, getting ever higher. Now, it wobbles when something goes wrong, but at the same time, it keeps going. It seems to manage to keep going. Now, various people like McIlvaney and his newsletter over the last 2 or 3 years, or Ada Parker, who was a financial journalist in South Africa, she died about 5 years ago, have repeatedly forecast a coming crash. But you see, I was reading about economic policy under the Thatcher government,
mm-hmm.
when the limits were more or less taken off the financial constraints were loosened, shall we say. Building societies were allowed to become banks. The building society is the equivalent of your savings and loans.
Right.
And you can go into a building society now and you can use it as a bank, which I do from time to time. Now, also, lending increased enormously. It's gone right off the scale. Now,
yeah.
this is not international, it's global. And, of course, we know it's happening in the United States as well. It's happening, generally speaking, around the globe. Because the wraps have been taken off. The fractional reserve banking principle, which was crooked enough in itself, with a multiple of, what was it, traditionally used,
10 times
the original deposit.
Used to be 4-1, then it went to 10. Now it's, I think it's 10-1. And now it does. In some instances, Barry, in the carry trade of Japan, it's nothing down. And you can buy a house in America with nothing down. There's nothing. You just give you the money.
Well, this is coming in various forms. My concern is that what, let us call them the middle classes, are sleepwalking into this, because life is fairly good, even if you're living on credit. And the crash must one day come.
Yep.
Now, I had some papers from New Zealand dealing with local government tax. I don't know what your equivalent term for local government would be in America, but you know, it's the government of towns and boroughs and cities.
Right, exactly.
Now, it was a 48-page paper called Communist Councils in New Zealand. And it followed a letter written by the author of is believed to be the author of the big report, a 4-page letter to a man who was reported in the Eastern Courier in New Zealand in April 2006 as being faced with selling his home up because of the draconian increase in his council tax. Now, this is coming, according to this New Zealand report, and it stems from the Fabian doctrine, the Fabian principle of eliminate through, of course, based on Karl Marx, based on the elimination of private property and inheritance tax. An inheritance, sorry, not tax, inheritance. In other words, anything that makes one independent, independent-minded, independent of a state, is to be removed.
That's right.
Now, a book was written by Tom Hartman, in the United States called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. Now, you're really talking, I think, in both cases, of that large section of the community which works hard, works for itself perhaps, provides for itself, has independence of mind, a degree of economic independence, and therefore is free to speak and exercise a certain amount of power. Now, it's a very difficult term to define, middle class, when you get down to brass tacks. It tends to be used as a trigger term. It tends to be used as a social trigger term. Now, in the United Kingdom, after the war, you could say after the poverty of the 1930s and the traditions, bad as they were, from the 19th century and industrialization, the working class is regarded as those, regardless of their skills, who wore blue overalls, worked in factories, and some of them were really highly skilled individuals, who drew their pay every week in cash in a pay packet. Now, the white-collar workers were those literally who wore clean clothes and were paid on a monthly basis. It was a very crude and arbitrary division. But, of course, it served, and it contained a huge amount of class prejudice, which has been promoted avidly in this country for years. And it's really a term which is burned out. Now, that middle class has become much wider and much more affluent. You're talking about thinking people. It doesn't matter who they are. London taxi drivers, skilled tradesmen. You meet people of all types. Now, this is the target, to remove their, take their teeth out, if you like. And one looks at this and thinks, crikey, this is a sort of, you know, this really is conspiracy theory. But I came across one term involved in this called Parliamentarians for World Order. Now, I was given some papers on this 20 years ago by a retired scientist who studied this question very carefully. And I see in this New Zealand report, they did exist. It was no imagination on this scientist's part. And they changed their title, I think, to Parliamentarians for Global Action. And they're tied up with the Rio Earth Summit, and they're tied up with the, shall we say, control of the global assets. And of course, we're into green movements and various preservation movements, but all driven by people from behind, by people like Maurice Strong, for instance.
Yes.
And here you find the network of the global elite, and they're gradually removing freedoms, the social freedoms, the economic freedoms of that broad...
Well, Maurice Strong is a Zionist Jew.
Is he?
Oh, big, well, yes.
If so, I mean, whether or not one slots him into the network you were talking about, so be it. But, I mean, if it's a fact, it's a fact.
Yes,
and
it is a fact.
Linked to.
Yeah.
But you see, a summit was held, I think it's 20 or more years ago, at which the global movers and shakers, the Rockefellers and so on, were present. And this is where it began to take shape. Now, the New Zealand paper records the trialing of property taxation. There is one term is property equity tax. And I suspect similar things are happening in the United States. Now, your property in this country, your ownership, own private property, has leapt by several multiples in this country over the last 20 years, and it's escalated in probably the last 5 or 6. Now, property values are only going to be pushed up by the money which is created to allow people to buy property.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are other issues, such as the increasing population.
But that's marginal. I mean, Britain's population has gone up maybe 6 or 8% in the last 20 years or so.
It's gone up, I think, by more than that. And, of course, we have the immigration thing. Now, this is where it's another complication, where Fabian socialism, of course, is international. It is the attack on the national identity and national boundaries. So, certainly in the European context, and with a colonial legacy too, which tends to work in both directions, we have virtually open borders, and we're a very small, crowded island. Now, you have the demand for accommodation, but you also have the value of the property. Now, the economic situation's changed, and it's been engineered. I didn't think there's much doubt about that. Such that to begin with, the feminist movement encouraged wives to work in the conventional husband and wife family.
Okay.
It was a right to work. But of course, circumstances vary. They weren't all able to work. Then the economic pressures became such that now husband and wives are forced to work if they wish to buy a home.
That's right.
Now, we're getting to the stage now where even that is becoming impossible.
And what's happening is because they're setting these traps, Barry,
yes,
where they start you out, and I know in Britain they've got the same thing. They've got these arms, these adjustable rate mortgages.
Yes.
And what happens is they lay the hook out there and they bait it with this deal, and they get you. Now what's going to end up happening in this forthcoming, I think, implosion, is that all of these properties, all of these ownerships are going to revert back to the banks, who, by and large, are controlled by this international group. And you're going to find that the bankers are holding on to the socialist control mechanism, the communist control mechanism.
You're right. You're absolutely you're right. The reports in the papers in the last few weeks are that the repossessions on housing mortgages have increased enormously. People are losing their homes.
That's right.
And figures are quoted at the monthly rate. Now, this of course, will affect business as well. Businesses are going bankrupt for the same economic squeeze.
That's right.
You see, not only has the value of one's house been pushed up, and value of the house I'm sitting in at the moment has been pushed up.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask for it to be pushed up, but making money readily available has led to this rise. The more people able to purchase houses, the greater the demand. And it's of course the ability is artificial when they're offered five times. Now it was four times, but one bank broke the limits and offered five times the combined salary as a basis for a mortgage.
Yeah.
Now the next thing that happens, of course, is that the value of one's house goes up to such an extent that through this New Zealand report, and it's coming in this country as well, houses are being revalued and your local taxation is being increased. Now, if you live on a fixed income, a pension, then you're in deep trouble, potentially. Now, property equity tax is where the value of the property is regarded as uninvested income on which you theoretically are earning a percentage. Now, that percentage income on the value of your property will be added to your local government tax. Now, the other point is that the expenditure in this country is being move sideways from central government to local government.
So these local taxes are needed because the federal tax or the national tax that used to take care of things like your local hospital or your school or your road maintenance is now being abrogated to the local government, and the local government can't get these things taken care of without squeezing the homeowner.
Well, you have to remember, of course, that local governments and local authorities borrow as well.
That's right, they do.
Now,
they issue the bonds. They issue bonds, that's right.
Yeah. When they're forced to borrow and the balloon goes up, they have to recoup that debt in some way.
That's right.
And the soft targets are the middle-class homeowners. And I think as far as the actual ownership of land is concerned, it's something like 3%, it appeared in the press recently, something like 3% of the entire sort of land mass of the United Kingdom. Now, it's a very small amount of land ownership, whatever's built on it in terms of housing, on which to focus for these charges. But this is the way it's drifting. Now, we've yet to see the crunch come. But it's clearly coming because we already have £1 trillion pounds of personal debt in this country. It's reached £1 trillion. Now, you cannot go on like this. And if we come back to healthcare and local government, well, not local government expenditure, government expenditure, healthcare, in this country at the moment, it is a bugger's muddle. Because those who are able to buy their way out of state health care, the great National Health Service, which was meant to be free health for all after the war, a great ideal. But you see, there are those in the upper regions who never get tainted with this, who can afford to buy their way out of health care just as they can afford to buy their way out of state education. And this, again, is where the focus is wrong. This is an area which is never targeted, never exposed. The ruling elite, as I call them. And there's a very grey area between the middle classes and this particular element. Now, what we have at the moment is healthcare in a state of flux. Now, it's faced with rationalizations, closures, job losses, really, changes that are falling over each other. Now, we've got, again, the government of ministers who, generally speaking, have never run a business in their lives. You wouldn't employ the majority of them to run a corner shop. They couldn't. And that starts with the Prime Minister. Now, they have a 1.3 million employer, the biggest employer in Europe, or one of them. And the organization, which is complex enough, with different theories about the way the organizations operate and so on and so forth, it's been evolving for years. And all of a sudden, we've had change after change after change imposed on it. The current one is a huge row brewing over maternity services. The rationalization, the increased traveling distances for potential mothers, of course, all tied to economies. They're tied. There's a degree of rationalization involved, sensible rationalization.
Well, Barry, this
to save money.
This actually, there was a precursor to this story I watched on French television, about 2 or 3 years ago, where the waiting time was 5, 6, 8, 10 months for certain operations, some cases even longer. And there would be arbitrary decisions on getting rid of your operation, or they would annulate your visit, and so they started out actually outsourcing the operations to France.
Oh, yes. Oh well, the books. So you see, they cook the books to suit themselves and change the parameters for what is an urgent operation, what is not. They're fiddling the thing the whole time.
But they don't have any problem coming up with another £12 billion to take care of take care of Basra's adventure and the Afghanistan adventure and the rest of that nonsense, do they?
No, and incidentally, the news was breaking tonight that a Chinook helicopter, the fifth in 2 or 3 weeks, has been brought down with, I think, the loss of 7 lives over Baghdad.
Yeah.
So that's another one, which is, well, it's expenditure, of course. It's keeping the military-industrial complex going. But you're quite right. I think there's a risk of my repeating myself from previous broadcasts, but, I mean, Lincoln created the greenback to finance the American Civil War. Lloyd George issued the Bradbury Note when money was wanted to finance the First World War. And the old social credit principle, which does no harm repeating, is that you don't run a train half empty for lack of tickets. You print more tickets. And this is what the money system is all about. Now, after the, and again, I can only leave it to draw parallels with the United States and other countries. After the war in this country, 50% of the nation's money was issued in cash and notes, coins in your pocket.
Yep.
Now, the other 50% was provided by the private banking system. Now, the current percentage issued by the government, because we've moved from cash in hand to credit card and checkbook banking, the government creates a mere 4%. Now, the balance of 96% has to be borrowed from the markets at interest. Now, no wonder we're paying a huge amount of our taxation to pay interest, broadly speaking, to the City of London and those living off it or investing in it. Now, one part of the country is living off the backs of the other. Now,
well, actually, the City of London actually has its tentacles around the globe.
Well, indeed, it's certainly no longer simply the city itself. But you see, the other thing is that the governments have the right to issue their own money, the right of seigniorage. Now, we may use less cash and coin, but the balance of that original 50% requirement could be issued in government bonds in some form and sold into the markets instead of borrowing our own money out of the markets. Now, this, of course, leads to inflation in the present context, the unlimited creation of money.
That's the argument
from the Treasury, which is a well-known falsehood, is that for the government to create more of its own money would be inflationary. Now, it wouldn't. It would merely substitute part of that huge 96% for its own money.
Well, this is the contention that James Gibbs Stuart has up in Scotland.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's a wise old guy. He studied this for years. He's an absolute expert. And he, in fact, was instrumental in getting a book called The Money Bomb placed in the hands of Margaret Thatcher in the early days of her government. And The Money Bomb exposed the entire system. And, of course, it has literally exploded since then when Margaret Thatcher was controlled eventually. But I don't know whether I told you the story of the Golden Key.
No.
Well, the Golden Key, at about the same time as Jimmy Gibbs Stuart was publishing The Money Bomb, the Golden Key came from a scheme for a treasure hunt, a national treasure hunt, in which...
Yes, you mentioned this to him. Go ahead and tell us.
Clues were revealed stage by stage as people sort of were sent in, you know, around the country in search of these clues. £50,000 was held in bond with a building society in Yorkshire as the ultimate prize. And a major store chain was mounting this, selling the book in its windows, in its shop windows. And there was a book, The Golden Key, which I have a copy. Now, all of a sudden, at the time James Gibbs Stuart's Money Bomb was given to Margaret Thatcher, this store chain suddenly shut down and returned all the books to James Gibbs Stuart, to the publisher. Now, people were beginning to talk about this. I remember this distinctly, you know, comments about what's it all about, what is this treasure hunt. It was becoming, you know, the public were getting interested, and all of a sudden it ceased to exist. It fizzled out. Now, behind that was a major figure in the Bilderberg Group.
Mm.
Now, you work that out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
An attempt to expose the money system by an expert, and in parallel, something he'd mounted as a national entertainment, shall we say, with a prize at the end, suddenly finished, evaporated.
Well, you see, Barry, when we take a look at these, and you know, a conspiracy is just two people planning to do something underhanded, and a theory. Every conspiracy that starts out as a conspiracy theory, but before it goes to a court proceeding, is a theory until it's provable. Now we know that these things that we've discussed tonight have their basis. In fact, we know that the things that are coming for us are almost unavoidable. I think because we're way down that path to our own demise. The question then becomes: I think if we do finally wake up the public, and I see rumblings of awakening here, I really see it. What is it we're going to be able to do to pull ourselves back from the brink of this disaster?
Well, I have no doubt in this country, and I think it probably applies in yours too, that until we have a much higher caliber of local government, and until those involved understand the financial system and what is happening, we're going to get nowhere. The second point is that not only have they got to do that, but they have got to take power back from the members of parliament. There's a rubber wall, a very heavy rubber wall between the parliamentary rule and the, shall we say, regional rule. I don't like using regional rule because it has implications for the EU breakdown of the Europe into regions. That's another matter altogether. But decentralized rule.
Yep.
There has got to be a very firm grip of those we elect and send to Parliament, in that they must represent our interests and not the interests of embedded corporate interests in the two main political parties and that they do not vote automatically with the party whip. They have got to stand up and be counted.
Now, but are you getting your elections in Britain done by computer?
I think they're playing with it, yes, post.
Well, the American system has been completely stolen with using computers. So, yeah, I mean, we're not even getting the people we elected.
No, I mean, any subterfuge is fair game in political circles. And I don't think, we could get to a stage where it takes public insurrection and physical control of MPs almost before anything changes.
Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson said we need to do that every 20 years, and that the blood of patriots needs to feed the tree of liberty.
Well, in that case, the circle is long overdue from, you know, coming round again. But I have an image. I have an image of people at the moment. And again, I think I mentioned this to you. There was a nature film on television about the threat to the albatross in the South Atlantic somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's an uninhabited little island, little more than a few rocks out of the South Atlantic.
Tristan Chacuna.
Yeah.
I think it was Tristan Chacuna or something.
Well, where it was, these big, fluffy albatross chicks were sort of sitting cozily on their nests.
Yeah.
Totally innocent of the fact that a giant mice or rats were eating out their guts from behind. Now, this, I'm afraid, is the problem with the public at large.
Yeah.
This is the life they're leading. They're, until they wake up and switch off their television sets and put away their golf clubs, they're not going to get anywhere. And
that's
I'm
right.
afraid it is something which threatens all organizations, all people who are aware, any movement attempting to challenge these powers, because the mass of the people simply at the moment don't want to know.
Well, Barry, I mean, did you think 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when you first started reading some of these historical documents and things of this, did you really, you couldn't have understood the depth of this at the time, because in fact, you're still finding how deep this rat hole really goes. Could you have imagined this? I personally, 3-4 years ago, I could not have imagined this. But you know something? The most powerful point for me was when it all dawned on me that instead of being just a theory in my mind, I knew it was real, and it was a devastating moment for me because it did happen in a moment. And at that time, I came to the realization that if we don't do something, there's going to be terrible suffering. And I don't know that we're going to avoid suffering in the first place, but terrible suffering, awful things. I mean, the 100 million dead last century is going to be a pittance compared to what we see coming up.
Well, people tend to take a rather fatalistic view of history and take a fatalistic view of what is happening as though, you know, it's outside their control. And I'm afraid in certain cases, and there are very few of us, suddenly one gets hooked on it, uneasiness over the years. And suddenly one realized, you know, through my meeting with this retired scientist, it changed my life, that there's something terribly wrong. And the more you read, such as being given some of the papers that she gave me, like Parliamentarians for World Order, and then a careful study of the press, not just a favorite newspaper, but across the board from political extremes and occasionally the foreign press. I mean, I've been looking at some newspapers that were sent to me from the Persian Gulf.
Mm.
And certain well-known books like Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley.
Yeah. Well, he was actually working with them, but he exposed a lot of their stuff, didn't
he? Oh, yes. But you see, once you get hooked on it, you know, it's like getting your clothing caught in the machinery. You get snaffled up. You can't go back.
No.
I didn't want to stop playing cricket or, you know, things like that. But I gave up because I realized, you know, it was taking time and I could only go one way.
Well, Barry, you and I, we do work closely on some of these research projects. And I tell you, you've been a wealth for me, and I urge everybody to do the due diligence that you called upon them to do in the beginning of this interview. These things that we've discovered should be discovered individually from everyone else. What we can do is give them the names, the places to go, point them in the right direction. But it's not until you really spend your own sweat on looking through these documents and these things and arrive at your own conclusions that the power of where we are, the frightening point of where we are in history becomes clearer. And then you can't be swayed from knowing the truth. See, when someone else tells you the facts, you can be swayed away from them. When you find them out for yourself and you're solid in your research, you can't be swayed because you've done the due diligence.
Well, I think this indeed is so. And those involved have to increase in numbers until you can join those dots up as well.
Yeah.
A lot of people have suspicions. They fear they're a bit odd. They're oddballs, you know, the odd ones out. When two or three people realize that they're thinking along the same lines and are prepared to gel, then the resistance will thicken.
Yeah.
But people have to be objective. They have to be absolutely fair and open-minded. And they have to draw conclusions from fact. And they have to learn. The thing is changing all the time. And you can't become bigoted in any of this work.
No.
Because you're just not going to reach the sort of the right conclusions.
Well, and not only that, Barry, you don't want to become what you're trying to get rid of either.
No. No.
And as soon as you start, using a line of bigotry or a line of that nature by saying it's all Muslims, all Jews, all this, all that,
yeah.
The word "all" should be a suspect word whenever you're trying to do this research.
Well, I think there's an element, of course, if you can't beat them, join them, which you're quite wrong.
Well, you know, Barry, we've done an hour, and I'll tell you, every time you come on, it flies by. This is a fastest hour in the world, I think, when I'm on the radio with you. The interesting thing about our conversations are we rarely talk about the same subjects, and if we do, we're always adding value, and I enjoy it so much. I want to tell you that this information that we've been sharing with the world and you've been sharing with me is making a difference. Now, whether or not we'll see fruit from it in our lifetimes, I can't be sure of that. What I can be sure of, Barry, is that we are making a change, because once you've changed a group of people, you can't undo that change. It's something that stays permanently in the mindset of the world, and I'm telling you, we've shifted the world a bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, life is all about people, ordinary people.
Yep.
And justice.
Injustice.
Race, color, or creed.
Well, you know, again, I want to thank you for coming on the French Connection, and it is a repeat visit for you, and I know that you're always interested in making sure that the stuff stays current and stays interesting and stays new. It did this time, Barry, as usual.
Well,
I want to thank you again, my friend.
Thank you for having me. I hope it has been useful.
And enjoy the rest of your evening, sir.
I'm going back to my model trains. It's too dark for cricket.
Enjoy.
Okay.
Thanks, Barry. Ladies and gentlemen, Lieutenant Colonel Barry Turner, retired friend of mine, working hard to help everybody understand that this is not a black and white issue, but a gray issue, and that this is not something that you rush to judgment, but rather take the facts that we've been able to provide you on the Internet and in these broadcasts, And start doing your own due diligence, because that is when you're going to feel solid about the effort we've made. And when we call on you to share this with other people, you're going to feel very strong in your ideas that you try to share with them. Because look, we need a bigger audience, and we need you to be a salesman for these facts. And the only way you're going to be able to sell these facts in an effective way is to know this information like I know it, like Barry Turner knows it, like Eric Huffschmidt knows it, and like Christopher Bolin knows it, and so many others. This information is all out there for you to learn, and I ask you to do that this day. Ladies and gentlemen, till the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying be well. Bye-bye now.